sanctions have been imposed on more than 40 countries by the United States, more than a third of the world population, in order to create dissent, hyperinflation, chronic shortages, and push for coups and destabilizations.
Sanction is not a way to go about achieving what they want, and we hope that they will heed our calls.
But we have deaths that could be attributed to the imposition of these measures, and I think all peoples around the world should stand and should denounce the seriousness of these policies and should stand together in order to counteract.
From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and radio affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. The word sanction is one of many derived from the Latin sanctionem. In the 16th century, it referred particularly to ecclesiastical decrees. Over time, it accrued various meanings, often radically contradictory, as are the derivatives sacrosanct and sanctimonious. Today, Merriam-Webster's first definition is, quote, an action that is taken or an order that is given to force a country to obey international laws by limiting or stopping trade with that country, not allowing economic aid for that country, etc. In fact, most of today's sanctions are actually violations of international law, as defined by the UN Charter, which stipulates that only the UN Security Council has the legal authority to impose them. They are better known as unilateral, coercive, and often lethal measures that the U.S. and its European allies impose to subjugate weaker nations who attempt to chart an independent path. Nations like Nicaragua, Venezuela, North Korea, Ethiopia, and Eritrea. Today, we'll hear from representatives of each of these sanctioned nations. These are excerpts of a webinar produced by the Sanctions Kill Coalition on January 23rd. First, we'll hear from Sanctions Kill organizer Sarah Flounders.
For over 2 years, the Sanctions Kill campaign has mounted an international campaign with thousands of supporters in many languages. It's a campaign to first get many solidarity committees talking to each other and working together to collectively explain and to focus world attention on the most brutal form of economic strangulation, more deadly than bombs. Sanctions have been imposed on more than 40 countries by the United States, more than a third of the world population, in order to create dissent, hyperinflation, chronic shortages, and push for coups and destabilizations. It's an effort to restrict development for that third of the world's global population. 2 years ago, we put out a desperate alert as it was clear that the pandemic raised the danger of sanctions to a new level. The Biden administration came in with grand promises to re-examine sanctions and the Trump foreign policy. Instead, this administration is doubling down on every Trump measure. The Treasury Department had even more devastating plans for harsher sanctions on Cuba, Venezuela, Syria, new threats on Russia, new sanctions on Nicaragua, provoking now an international crisis over the continued expansion of NATO to the very borders of Russia, new military threats against China, new conditions on Iran, continuing war in Syria, naval blockades and sanctions on Yemen continuing, new threats on Korea. This is not what was promised or expected. New sanctions on Ethiopia, Cambodia, intensified sanctions on Mali, and a more calculated corporate role for billionaires to use Facebook for coups and color revolutions, to use internet shutdowns to isolate, to restrict and prevent every spare part and every form of technology cut off through sanctions. We could look at the US complete collapse in Afghanistan and then consciously stripping the cupboards bare. Every dollar, food, and essential medicine seized and taken out of the country, including Afghanistan's own meager funds frozen. So as we are working together and combining our efforts against this monstrous, expanding crime, we've seen an exciting new development. A whole number of sanctioned countries, in order to survive, are consciously cooperating with each other. They're refusing economic siege warfare, isolation, and systemic starvation of their populations. There's resistance on a new and creative level, and that's what we're going to be looking at today. China with new trade and Belt and Road development for Nicaragua, with Venezuela playing a crucial role in oil with Iran, with Russia and China providing aid to Syria to rebuild, even as US bombs continue, and Syria in turn sending oil to Lebanon to keep its hospitals running. The countries of Africa no longer face sanctions and isolation. They have other options now for economic development. This is a political and economic process that's just beginning. The big difference is that no country is standing alone against the US monolith. Every country is learning new forms, whether it's urban agriculture, greenhouses, survival techniques, and exchanges with each other. Our efforts too are only beginning because we need to do so much more in this interconnected world to defend every one of these sanctioned countries.
That was Sanctions Kill organizer Sarah Flounders. Next, we'll hear from Carlos Ron, Venezuelan Vice Minister for North America.
I'm very happy to be here. And again, it's a very important gathering as we stand together against the use of this weapon, which is the use of the illegal coercive measures, as they are called. Sanctions is the word that the United States likes to use. But as we all know, the only legal sanctions acceptable throughout the world are the ones that are issued by the United Nations Security Council. And this is not the case. The United States has a unilateral and illegal policy, which uses basically to coerce other governments into accepting or changing their own policies and to comply with the intentions that the United States has on those countries. Venezuela, since 1999, has been subjected to a hybrid war. And this means that this is a war by all types of aggressions, from the military aggressions that we have seen, like attempted coups and other attacks. There was, in more recent times, a drone attack against President Maduro in 2018, attempted blackout against the whole country, mercenary invasions, and so forth. But this is just part of a whole other group of actions, including legal indictments, including a media narrative that questions Venezuela's democratic practices, including a political recognition of a man who a day like today, 3 years ago, claimed to be the president of Venezuela. And after that, has just unleashed another set of sanctions and unilateral measures against Venezuela. But specifically, we want to talk about the effect and the aggression that has been set against Venezuela with the use of those legal measures, those measures that basically attack Venezuela's financial, economic system and access to the international financial system. Like Sarah said before, we are the fifth most sanctioned country in the world by the United States. This has been done through laws and 7 executive orders, but basically the implication of this is that we have over $7 billion frozen in bank accounts. It's $30 billion of assets altogether that Venezuela could use or should use for its necessities, such as combating the pandemic. And we cannot do it because these are under these illegal measures. Over 190 officials or persons related to the Venezuelan governments have been by the United States with personal actions. 53 businesses, 10 of them state-owned, but the rest is from the private sector. And the list can go on. I could tell you about 69 ships, 30 oil tankers, 58 airplanes, and much more. But in essence, you have taken away from a country like Venezuela the capability to interact in the international financial system by blocking bank transactions, by freezing its accounts, by prohibiting the commercialization of its main resources like oil or gold, by banning any type of transactions related to debt. So any other country can simply renegotiate or restructure its debts in foreign banks. Venezuela cannot do that. But Venezuela has also seen measures taken against the food program, the subsidized food program distribution called CLAP, which is Committees for Local Supply and Production. We've seen our maritime fleet, our ships, like I said before, are being blocked. But we've seen shipments coming to Venezuela being stopped by the United States and being even taken, as we saw in the case of some ships coming from Iran with fuel and for other materials to ease our oil production, that they have been taken, and the contents of those ships coming to Venezuela have been sold off as if we were talking about pirates in the Caribbean in several centuries ago. Conviasa, which is Venezuela's flag airline, has also been sanctioned. And this is critical. You know, the sanction came into place in the middle of the pandemic after we have been using this airline as part of the program to repatriate some of our migrants who have been to other countries, who in the middle of their stay in other countries saw the necessity to come back because, first of all, they were tricked or they were held there for different reasons other than what they expected. And then when they needed to come back, the Venezuelan government offered the opportunity to do so free of charge through the Venezuelan airline, but that was also sanctioned. And some of those trips have been impossible to carry out any longer because of those measures taken against the airline. You have to think about what these sanctions, what these actions do to a country, specifically in the sense of the maintenance of the public services in the country, when most of the technology and most of the equipment belong to other to technologies foreign from Venezuela. For example, here, electricity, the companies that would come to Venezuela and do maintenance and or spare parts that we need to make sure that the electricity runs appropriately, well, that is affected by these measures. There's also the issue of overcompliance with the use of sanctions. And overcompliance means that many companies or many other actors will not trade with Venezuela, will not sell Venezuela things it needs because they're afraid of what consequences there may be to them because of the U.S. sanctions. Not because they're listed, not because they're specifically stated, but because they fear what other actions can be taken. So these companies come into this overcompliance. See, technically, for example, Venezuela should be able to access food and medicine outside because they should not be under any of the sanctioned regime policies. But in truth, in reality, a lot of the companies don't want to sell to Venezuela or don't want to provide these items to Venezuela because they fear what things may happen to them. And just to give you an example, this is not me speaking on this, but if you see letters that have been written on this issue by senators, by representatives of the U.S. Congress, you could very well see where this is mentioned. And I'll give you just one brief statement from one of these letters in February of 2021, a letter signed by members of Congress, including Representative Ilhan Omar, where it says, "Dozen members of Congress expressed great concern to the previous administration about the way that the U.S. sanctions were hampering a global response to both the public health crisis and the economic crisis perpetuated by the COVID-19 pandemic. Existing protocols and licenses have proved woefully insufficient to meet the enormity of the challenges shared by the people around the world in the face of the pandemic. Even when licenses and humanitarian exemptions are available, moreover, there is a persistent problem of overcompliance, particularly from the financial sector. This has led to catastrophic humanitarian consequences in various parts of the world." These are U.S. Congress members speaking. This is not me. This is not somebody from anti-U.S. Organization. This is the truth being spoken by those who, in a way, participate also in the perpetration of these attacks on our countries. But I think it's very important that we must stand against the use of this weapon that sanctions are now. This is the same as warfare. This is just another type of warfare. But we have deaths that could be attributed to the imposition of these measures. And I think all peoples around the world should stand and should denounce the seriousness of these policies and should stand together in order to counteract them.
That was Carlos Ron, Venezuelan Vice Minister for North America. That was Lives in the Balance by Richie Havens. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Ann Garrison. Next, we'll hear from Francisco Campbell, Nicaraguan ambassador to the U.S.
The heightened hostility and systematic aggression of the United States and its imperialist allies against the people of Nicaragua is the continuation of a policy carried out against our country throughout history, and a reminder that interventionism in Nicaragua is one of the most persistent manifestations of US foreign policy in the Western Hemisphere. As early as 1823, when the United States enacted the Monroe Doctrine, its guiding policy framework to exert influence in Latin America and the Caribbean, interventionism in the affairs of Nicaragua became a constant of US policy. From the signing of the Clayton-Bulwer Treaty of 1850 regarding control of the proposed Nicaragua Canal to outright recognition in 1856 of William Walker, a U.S. mercenary, as president of Nicaragua, who went on to reinstate slavery and seek annexation to the United States. This interventionist policy included deployment of Marines to overthrow President José Santos Zelaya in 1910, and military assistance to conservative General Emiliano Chamorro in the 1912 assassination of General Benjamin Celeron, who had opposed US interference in Nicaragua. United States Marines occupied Nicaragua from 1912 until 1933, when they were expelled by our national hero, the General of Freedmen, Augusto Calderon Sandino, who was assassinated in an ignominious act of betrayal by General Anastasio Somoza Garcia in 1934, with the permission and backing of the US ambassador at the time. The brutal Somoza dictatorship had the full support of every US president from Franklin Roosevelt to Jimmy Carter. All of these presidents, Democrats and Republicans, turned a blind eye to the gross human rights violations committed by the dictator and facilitated the looting of the natural resources of the country, along with exploitation of the vast majority of the people. After 43 years of terror and systematic human rights violations, the Somoza dictatorship finally came to an end when his National Guard was defeated by the Sandinista Revolution in 1979, marking the beginning of democracy in Nicaragua for the first time in the history of the country. This revolutionary democratic victory for the people of Nicaragua was soon subverted when US interventionism returned in the form of the Contra War that caused over 50,000 deaths and completely destroyed the economy, along with systematic interference since 1990 in the Nicaragua electoral processes through corrupt, anti-democratic, and blatantly illegal practices. Immediately following the victory of Comandante Daniel Ortega and the FSLN in the 2006 elections, the US government renewed its aggression against Nicaragua in the form of financial, technical, and intelligence assets and resources amounting to several $100 million that were channeled through a few dozen individuals and local NGOs for the purpose of establishing anti-Sandinista and anti-government media structures and campaign to instigate dissent and violence in urban and rural areas, as well as advocate for illegal and unilateral measures against the Nicaraguan people in flagrant violation of Nicaragua laws and basic principles of international law. The 2018 coup attempt was the culmination of this policy of aggression. It cost the lives of 198 Nicaraguan sisters and brothers and countless others injured. One in four small businesses were closed because of the impact that barricading of roads and highways had on the economy. 98,000 jobs were lost, and the overall damage to the national economy was estimated at over US$27 billion. The people of Nicaragua were able to defeat the coup by calling to memory the shared history of struggle against US interventionism. The profound sense of national dignity, patriotism, and pride was in full display against this new attempt by the local oligarchy and US neocolonialists to subjugate Nicaragua. The Nicaragua model of participatory democracy, the people president, prove its mettle in this most recent confrontation and has been strengthened through the celebration of regional elections in 2019 and national elections in November of last year. Overcoming the effects of the coup attempt, Nicaragua has returned to the path of integral, comprehensive economic growth, maintaining key social programs that have allowed the country to reduce poverty, ensure free and universal quality healthcare and education, citizen security, and food sovereignty. The building of infrastructure in the form of highways, hospitals, and schools, as well as access to basic services, reducing vulnerability to the worsening effects of climate change, all attest to the growing strength and resilience of the Nicaragua model of human development and participatory democracy, which ensures that all sectors of society have a voice in the building of a more prosperous and diverse nation, aiming to eradicate poverty, hunger, and inequality, and prioritizing gender equity in all areas as one of its foundational components. Nicaragua is the best performing Central American country in terms of handling of the COVID-19 pandemic, which is a direct result of Comandante Ortega's commitment to ensure access to free, quality healthcare services for all, and a reflection of the confidence the Nicaraguan people have in their family and community-centered health model. As an expression of the steadfast and unwavering determination to defend and exercise our right to national sovereignty, self-determination, and independence, Nicaragua has re-established ties with the People's Republic of China, a permanent member of the United Nations Security Council, and began the process of withdrawing from the Organization of American States. These strategic decisions will undoubtedly open new avenues and possibilities for Nicaragua to move ahead in its commitment to achieve integral, comprehensive development with social justice for all. Because of these achievements and the good example they represent, Nicaragua is seen as a threat to US foreign policy that through illegal, coercive, and unilateral measures seeks to perpetuate neocolonial domination and exploitation. As of 2022, almost 2 billion people from over 40 countries are being denied the right to development due to these illegal sanctions, which in times of pandemic and as we grapple with the effects of climate change is nothing short of a crime against humanity. Nicaragua maintains that the only legal sanctions are those of the United Nations Security Council and has demanded that all unilateral, coercive, and illegal measures imposed on our countries or on any other country be immediately eliminated. The firm pronouncement that sanctions still must be made to resonate loudly throughout the world because of the immense suffering and destruction they are causing. It is imperative that all sanctions be eliminated, allowing our countries the space and resources needed to effectively address the myriad of challenges to overcome in our efforts to build more just and fair societies with opportunities and benefits for all. This is the purpose and goal of the successful Nicaragua participatory democracy model, also known as the People President, that was reaffirmed by the overwhelming vote of the Nicaraguan people in the November 7 election, granting a new five-year term, which formally began this past January 10th, when President Ortega and Vice President Murillo were sworn into office. The struggle continues, and we are confident that justice in the end will prevail.
That was Francisco Campbell, Nicaraguan ambassador to the U.S. Was One Love by Manu Chao and Playing for Change. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. Next, we'll hear from Elias Amare, Eritrean-American journalist and host of Horn of Africa TV.
It would be great if we could eliminate or scrap off the usage of the word sanctions because, well, one of great writer George Orwell, in his essay Politics in the English Language, says how language is used by aggressors to camouflage brutality. So collateral damage, which is really the massacre of civilians, becomes a nicely sounding phrase called collateral damage. And sanctions is in that kind of category of obfuscation. What it really is economic warfare on people. strangulation of a nation's economy. So whenever we say sanctions, it means economic warfare, war on the people. That is what is happening to my people, the Eritrean people in the Horn of Africa. This is not the first time that sanctions were imposed on us. Previous sanctions were imposed on Eritrea, actually, under the rubric of the UN Security Council. So even at the UN Security Council, unjust, illegitimate sanctions could be imposed. In 2009, the regional proxy regime on the Horn of Africa, called the TPLF minority regime, at that time in power in Ethiopia, ignited a war on Eritrea under the pretext of a border, but largely because Eritrea did not submit to the diktats of the empire. It wanted to chart its own independent national path, self-reliance. It rejected foreign aid. It kicked out eventually the U.S. aid because Eritrea realized the U.S. aid was up to no good. U.S. aid is just a front organization for the CIA, as renowned international law professor Francis Boyle coiled it. So for these reasons, Eritrea was punished and a war was waged on it by a regional proxy force, the TPLF minority regime. It is now kicked out of power by popular uprising in Ethiopia. But at that time, the TPLF regime was ruling Ethiopia for 27 years, from 1991 up to 2018. And it brought much misery on the people of Ethiopia, to the minority regime. So it was minority rule under the guise of ethnic federalism, but tribalism, essentially, whereby a minority can impose its rule over the rest of the majority of the Ethiopian people. It waged war on Somalia, and because Eritrea opposed the invasion of Somalia in 2006-2007, as punishment, Eritrea was put under sanctions regime or economic warfare at the UN Security Council. This was due to the machinations of the United States. If you examine WikiLeaks documents of that period, say from 2006 up to 2011, you will see all the secret meetings between then Ambassador Susan Rice at the United Nations and the Ethiopian dictator Meles Zenawi, how they conspire, they plan for the sanctions to be imposed on Eritrea. Another border conflict was manufactured with small neighboring country, Djibouti also, to ramp up the other bogus charge that Eritrea helped the Al-Shabaab terrorists in Somalia. This was preposterous and utterly bogus because anyone who knows the struggle, the Eritrean revolution and Eritrean's long struggle, knows that Eritrea is against terrorism. In fact, it was the victim of terrorism, jihadi extremist terrorism. And so we suffered a lot. From 2009 up to 2018, we were alone in the wilderness fighting these unjust sanctions at the UN Security Council. They tried to isolate us. They tried to demonize the president of the country, the Eritrean Defense Forces. Bogus human rights charges were brought against Eritrea in Geneva, the UN Human Rights Council. So the empire basically can do what it wants. From 2009 up to 2018, Eritrea struggled. Eventually, inside Ethiopia, the proxy regime of the TPLF, that was the trusted ally of the United States in the West, was overthrown when people have had enough. The Ethiopian people rose up in a popular protest for 3-4 years. And eventually, this minority regime was kicked out of power. Currently, our neighbor Ethiopia, with whom Eritrea has finally made peace, once the puppet proxy regime of the TPLF was overthrown from power, the conflict between the two countries was resolved quickly. But the empire doesn't sleep. It wants to resuscitate this trusted former proxy regime of the TPLF. And in November 2020, a year ago, the TPLF regime from its Tigray province in the north once again unleashed war on Ethiopia and Eritrea also. So under this circumstance, both Eritrea and Ethiopia had to defend themselves against this aggression and crush this outlaw terrorist force, which is destabilizing the entire Horn of Africa region. And once again, then the sanctions that were lifted from Eritrea in 2018, once peace was achieved with Ethiopia, because all the charges that were brought against Eritrea at the UN Security Council were proven to be false. And both Ethiopia and Somalia said these sanctions must be lifted. They are unjust. Eritrea is a force for stability in the region now. So finally, those sanctions, those UN Security Council sanctions that were engineered by the United States had to be lifted. There was no longer any excuse left. But then after a brief respite, recently also, last November, unilateral U.S. sanctions or economic warfare was once again imposed on Eritrea. And we find ourselves again fighting and resisting this unjust economic warfare by the empire.
That was Elias Amaru, Eritrean-American journalist, organizer, and host of Horn of Africa TV. Next, we'll hear from Deacon Yosef Tefera, chairman of the Ethiopian American Civic Council.
The Ethiopian American Civic Council is an organization. It's a civic organization established. This is our seventh year. We engaged essentially our constituent of Ethiopian Americans to be able to civically engage and thereby gain their own political capital to deal with concerns that we have not only here domestic in our own region where we live, but also of that of the state of Ethiopia.
We're a civic organization that represent close to about a million Ethiopian Americans here in the United States. But we start, even though that we focused on more the constituent political campaigns that garnered us some support from congressional members, that we were able to draft and pass the first African resolution known as HR 128. That came at a very critical time of the recent Ethiopian politics. And that is when the Ethiopian people rose up and fought against this ethnic regime. This resolution that we sponsored sort of kind of created the perfect storm for the downfall of this regime in Ethiopia back in 2018. Really, one needs to look at the region at large in order to understand why the United States in this particular time is favoring TPLF, seems at least to favor TPLF. It is because of the Ethiopian strategic location on the Red Sea and finally being able to unite its overall national interest with that of Eritrea and also in Somalia, and I believe also South Sudan. So creating a sort of like a broader sense of confederation for all these countries to benefit from their natural resources, security arrangement, and become more or less truly independent countries. President Isaias is known to be a very, very independent leader. And so having the Red Sea in itself, they made sure that if he cannot be a yes man as the force that run the country of Ethiopia, TPLF, then they basically put him under a serious sanctions that lasted as long as the government of Eritrea has come to existence. And one can see the devastation that has caused. And now, even in this current climate, what started it all is the fact that TPLF, after they've been removed from power 3 years ago, they decided that they are going to attack Ethiopia and Eritrea. And they essentially launched a rebel attack against the Ethiopian Northern Command that was located in the region where they are in power. And this kind of caused the cascading effect of the current conflict that we have today. Clearly, the United States came on the side of TPLF. One could see how we have been dragged into the United Nations Security Council almost a dozen times in a single calendar year for all sorts of issues. And many congressional members and senators favoring TPLF, one in fact drafted a resolution citing that Ethiopia in fact has committed genocide against its own people. But Ethiopian American Civic Council with Senator Jim Inhofe of Oklahoma, together we campaigned very heavily and we were successful in removing that provision out of Pentagon appropriation bill for 2022. And having said that, a sanction is usually a sign of a failed foreign policy. That's how you resort to that. So is an actually declaring war on a country. Usually when foreign policies and diplomatic efforts fail, usually end up in resorting to that. Well, since sanction in a sense is a form of war, a quiet war, and it is particularly waged against the ordinary people, it usually doesn't affect the leaders. Usually what happens in the case, for example, in Ethiopia, the African Growth Opportunity Act, AGOA, which Ethiopia benefited close to about $300 million of the tax-exempt export to the U.S., Ethiopia was removed at the end of December last year by President Biden from this Opportunity Act. So we feel that the situation, such as the attempt to classify Ethiopia as a country committed genocide, that usually is like a down payment for sanction to be declared in so many levels. And we're new to this. Ethiopia is new to this. Ethiopia traditionally has been a strategic ally of the United States since the United States basically backed TPLF, the rebel group that attacked Ethiopia. Ethiopia was put under this vice, economic vice, and as such, in which we have never experienced before. We've seen it in other countries. And we know also the extent of how powerful, how devastating these measures are, because the United States does not seem to act alone. It has other international institutions that brings to bear these financial institutions, such as World Bank, International Monetary Funds, even other countries and European countries, which seem to parallel their policies, economic policy in particular, with that of the United States. A country like Ethiopia really is, we are defenseless in terms of bearing the full threat of sanction by the United States. We work as a civic organization to bring, to have a better or a stronger bilateral relationship between Ethiopia and the United States. We've done, I mean, this relationship didn't start today. It has been for 118 years. As you know, Ethiopia has never been colonized. There are only about two or three countries on the entire world that have never been colonized. And that one happened to be Ethiopia. So what we are advising and campaigning and lobbying is by saying the United States sanction will not work on any country that has never bowed down to foreign power, whether it is physically colonizing Ethiopia or subjecting to neocolonial threats. So there has to be a better way of dealing, of wanting or getting what they seek, provided it is mutual beneficiary for both countries, and that it respects the sovereignty of Ethiopia. And I think somebody mentioned earlier, which is, I believe is a good point, is, you know, the days of superpower, as we know it, is quite numbered now. We can see the writing on the wall. There are other emerging powers coming in particularly, these powers are highly creating a regional sphere of influence. And so when the United States uses a very forceful sanctional measure, and if it fails to achieve what it tended to do, and it loses its leverage and influence in the region, that space that the United States vacate will not remain being in a vacuum. These other emerging powers are ready to occupy those space. So in the long term, sanctions don't work. And in fact, it works against the interest of the country that is actually using it as an instrument, as a coercive measure. But until then, though, the devastation effect is quite staggering.
That was Deacon Yosef Tefera, chairman of the Ethiopian American Civic Council. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. Next, we'll hear from Erica Jung of the Korean grassroots organization, Nonutuo.
On December 13th, the Biden administration symbolically agreed to an end of war declaration. And while we welcome gestures like this, the U.S. has in the meantime failed to address any of the conditions that North Korea had asked for, such as lifting certain sanctions and stopping military exercises. Instead, the U.S. continues to employ sanctions and isolation tactics against North Korea, undermining the country's sovereignty and subjecting its 25 million people to a brutal siege that has lasted for decades. Just 3 days prior to this, the Biden administration announced a new round of sanctions, targeting individuals and entities in North Korea, as well as China, Bangladesh, Russia, and Myanmar on December 10, 2021, the 73rd anniversary of Human Rights Day. Biden argued that North Korea's nuclear and missile program continues to constitute an unusual and extraordinary threat to the national security, foreign policy, and economy of the United States. Now, let us review in U.S.-Korean relations who is the real threat. The U.S. during the Korean War killed 3 to 5 million Koreans. This is a number that amounts to genocide. The U.S. dropped more aerial bombs on North Korea than it did in the entire Pacific theater of World War II. And to this day, the Korean War is not over. The ceasefire signed in 1953 did not end the war. In fact, the U.S. kept almost 1,000 nuclear missiles in South Korea pointed at the North for nearly 50 years. To this day, the U.S. occupies the South with almost 30,000 troops and regularly conducts military exercises that rehearse invasions of the North with as many as 300,000 soldiers at a time. Now, in this context, the North Korean development of nuclear weapons is a strategy of deterrence against the threat of U.S. imperialist aggression. North Korea can't trade with other countries, receive international loans, or import fuel or much of anything else. Sanctions impact the daily life of all North Koreans. From agriculture to industry and medicine, they impact everything. Most things North Koreans need, they have to produce for themselves. There is no getting it from somewhere else. Sanctions impact water, sanitation, hygiene, and healthcare infrastructure. According to UNICEF, over 9.75 million people do not have access to safely managed drinking water. And one of the many types of items that North Korea is banned from importing due to sanctions is water sanitation equipment. Under sanctions, seeds, fertilizers, and agricultural equipment and other types of machinery are banned. And contrary to popular narratives that claim North Korea's government is intentionally withholding food from its population, Food insecurity in the country is driven by lack of access to modern agricultural equipment and techniques. And this is further amplified by natural disasters and the impacts of climate change. In fact, North Korea has a public food distribution system, but it's unable to access the necessary agricultural imports from the world market. Sanctions also hugely affect the quality of healthcare available in North Korea. While the country has a national public healthcare system that provides medical care to everyone free of charge, and its health indicators are much higher than in countries with comparably sized economies, because of sanctions, North Korea's healthcare system faces shortages of medicine and equipment that impact its ability to treat many preventable diseases. This is the reason why, for instance, up to 37% of deaths among children under 5 are caused by pneumonia and diarrhea. Under UN sanctions, all metal items are banned. Think about what that means. Metal is everywhere. Sterilizers, ambulances, medical appliances, x-ray machines, operating tables, hospital beds, water filters, metal tubes, pipes, pipe fittings, the list is endless. And it's these kind of items that could be used to prevent and treat common health problems in North Korea. If the basis of sanctions and U.S. aggression against North Korea is really a concern for human rights, one might wonder why these sanctions seem to so obviously trample on North Koreans' right to live. While the UN makes exemptions on a case-by-case basis for humanitarian aid, applicants for these exemptions, mainly international and non-governmental organizations, face significant challenges, from long wait times for review and approval of exemption requests to unrealistic shipping requirements. These administrative barriers to humanitarian aid have had fatal consequences. In just 2018, delays and funding shortfalls resulted in an estimated 3,968 preventable deaths. The U.S. condemns human rights in North Korea, yet in the same breath, it violates these very rights by imposing deadly sanctions. The U.S. claims to want to end the Korean War, yet in the same breath, the U.S. imposes greater sanctions as an act of warfare, knowing full well that North Korea sees lifting sanctions as a precondition to negotiations in ending the war. We must not be fooled by the rhetoric of the United States, but look instead at its actions. Despite these repressive U.S. policies, however, North Korea has resisted sanctions and managed to hold its own. North Korea has persevered through hardship and shown remarkable strength and determination in overcoming these many challenges. Since the arduous march, a time of famine in the 90s, the country has been gradually recovering, having developed its own technology and infrastructure to rebuild, feed, and clothe its people. Its development model is centered around the Juche ideology, which emphasizes self-reliance, self-sufficiency, and self-confidence. The North Korean people continue to stay resilient and adapt to the many challenges they face through remarkable advancements in agriculture, energy, and textile and steel production. It has resisted sanctions by investing in industries that they are otherwise cut off from. Through carbon chemistry, North Korea has created their own gasoline, synthetic resins, synthetic rubber, agricultural pesticides, paints, medicines, chemical fertilizers, and more. These are all products that are typically made through petrochemistry with oil. And though North Korea cannot access oil, it has found other ways to provide for its people. They are adapting their lives because of sanctions in acts of resistance and survival as the national ideology of Juche manifests itself in all parts of the North Korean economy.
That was Erica Yoon of the Korean grassroots organization, Noruto. Fuad Izadi, Iranian associate professor at the University of Tehran, sent a statement to the webinar, but he was unable to join because, according to the Zoom website, Iran is among the regions or countries who are, quote, unable to access Zoom for regulatory reasons. The others are Cuba, Syria, North Korea, and Crimea. And that concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by me, Ann Garrison, and Polina Vasiliev. Our executive producers are Akua Holt, Polina Vasiliev, and Steve Seltzer. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. You can follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD and on Facebook at COVID Race and Democracy. I've been your host, Ann Garrison. Thanks for listening.